Morning. I'm delighted to welcome students from Randolph High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar and this court. We've run this program for many years now. Students are invited to come to the court and hear an oral argument. If the students agree to come, they're given some materials about the case. They listen to oral argument, and at noon, a justice of this court is assigned to speak with the students about the procedures of the court in taking and hearing and deciding cases, not the substantive issues of the case. And everyone is invited to join the students at that discussion, including counsel. This is a national award-winning program, and therefore we're delighted to have the Randolph High School students with us today. The marshal has a synopsis of the case we're about to hear. I suppose a summary of the facts and legal issues is a better description. If anyone here would like that synopsis, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you the summary. Matt, I shall go forth, and let me introduce the students to the court. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robensack. Justice Robensack is the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser. And the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, we will now call our first case, which is Vicki L. Blazing versus Zurich American Insurance Company. Arguing on behalf of American Family Mutual Insurance Company is David J. Is it Plainer or Plainer?
It is Plainer, Justice.
Plainer. Justice Plainer. Mr. Plainer. I'm the justice, you're the attorney. You may proceed.
Attorney David Plainer appearing for intervener, respondent petitioner, American Family Mutual Insurance Company. This case presents the legal question of whether the omnibus statute, section 632.32, requires that a policyholder's auto liability policy defend and indemnify an alleged tortfeasor for injuries to the policyholder herself under the theory that the tortfeasor is a permissive user of the policyholder's vehicle. In the trial court, although the court did not directly address the omnibus statute per se, he found that the result sought by Menards, in other words, a finding that Menards was a permissive user, was so counterintuitive, essentially, that it was absurd, that it could not have been the intended result of the legislature.
And that really goes to the heart, it seems to me, of this case. And specifically, as I was preparing and reading the briefs, I'm curious to know how you would articulate a distinction between this fact pattern and the facts in Bowling, especially, despite, you know, I'm not talking about the particularities of the conduct, but as to the essential rule that was articulated there. How would you articulate a differentiation between this and Bowling and, of course, the, I'll call it, Lucas Sawitz case, for lack of better understanding of the correct pronunciation? How do you articulate a distinction between those cases and this?
Justice, I believe the facts, and I'll focus on Lucas Sawitz. I'm not sure if that's the proper pronunciation.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Sure. Focusing on the Lucas Sawitz case, factually, I think they are very similar.
Right, the concrete block there.
Correct.
Right.
However, the Lukasiewicz case simply didn't consider the issues
it
that
didn't
we were
perform
here.
The analysis of absurd and unreasonable, but it seems to me that that was the consequence, that was the result of the decision. So that's why I'm asking you more about bowling, because I understand that the analysis was not performed in the 1969 case, but in bowling they went through the analysis of the use of the vehicle, and we have the case where the hunters were unloading the firearms, and that was a reasonable use. How do you differentiate the legal consideration in this case and those?
Well, again, factually, I think they are...
I'm asking legally.
Legally, I think the distinction is that the absurdity issue and the question of whether that type of claim was intended to be subject to the omnibus statute just wasn't addressed in that case. And if it was, I would argue that that case and Lukasiewicz should be decided the same as we're arguing here, that the omnibus statute should not compel coverage under the injured policyholder's liability policy for the tortfeasor.
Isn't this just a case of primacy? American Family agreed in this policy to insure any user within the policy, okay? Let's just assume this is a use within the policy, right? The peculiarity in the case is that another insured gets hurt, right?
Yes.
Okay. So let's just take it into an everyday situation. It's my car. I'm the insured. I have a friend who has a license but doesn't have a car and has none of her own insurance, and she's driving my car with my permission. I'm not negligent. My friend, the driver, is negligent, right? Everyday occurrence. And I am hurt in my own car, driven by my friend, right?
Yes.
And it's all insured by, and I'm insured by American Family. American Family going to pay me for my injury at the fault of my friend, the driver, who's an insured under your policy?
Our position is, under the liability portion of your policy, the answer would be no.
Why not?
Because it goes against, and I'll start with the language of the omnibus statute. And I think
Do you have an exception for me as the insured on the liability? If I'm injured, do you have an exception? You don't pay the insured if you're injured?
I think some policies do have an injury.
But yours, this American Family's, in this case, is there an exception?
This
an
particular
exclusion?
Policy, I don't believe, has an exclusion.
That's what I thought. Okay. So under the policy, you agree to pay whoever is a driver with permission, right?
Yes.
You cover them, right? So you cover my friend, Ann Walsh Bradley, right? For liability, right?
If she borrows your car and injures a third person, yes.
Pardon me?
Yes, if she
Okay,
injures a
but
third
why
person.
Doesn't she injure me? Where in your policy does it say I can't get covered for liability?
I believe, Justice, excuse me, in order to answer that, we have to start back with the language of the omnibus statute.
Okay.
That I think that is really at issue here.
All right.
And what it says under sub 3A is that coverage provided to the named insured, the policyholder, which would be you in your example,
right,
applies in the same manner and under the same provisions to any person using any motor vehicle described in the policy.
Mm-hmm.
So we start with that proposition.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the phrase, coverage provided to the named insured, applies in the same manner.
Mm-hmm.
I think the parties here, when we get to the heart of it, are effectively disputing what that phrase means.
Mm-hmm.
Menard's position, and I think what the Court of Appeals followed, was that if we take the policyholder, Ms. Blazing, here, and put her in the position of the tortfeasor, and say if she is putting material in her vehicle and she injures someone, then she would have liability coverage, and therefore, if the Menard's employee injures someone, He has liability coverage. Our approach is different. Our interpretation of that language is that if we put Ms. Blazing in the position of the Menards employee and we ask if she injures herself, if she is loading the boards into the pickup herself mm-hmm. and drops them on her foot, does she have liability coverage mm-hmm. under her own policy? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no.
I don't have any problem with that. If I'm negligent and injure my hand at home under the homeowners, I'm not going to recover. But if Ann's at my house, Justice Bradley, and she negligently injures me, and if the homeowners has this kind of omnibus language, why shouldn't I be covered? Because if we take your principle and position here, then any time I'm in my own car, unless I'm driving myself, if I'm injured by the driver, I don't have any coverage. And that's what bothers me. I don't have any trouble here. Either Zurich is going to pay or you're going to pay. The only question is how much each of you. This is a fight between two insurance companies. I'm much more interested in the basic underlying principle here that you don't want to cover me as an injured party just because I'm an insured, even though I'm injured by another insured. So you're not going to cover Justice Bradley driving my car, and so I'll just have to sue Justice Bradley and hope that she's got enough money after I've paid you premiums to cover her.
Counselor, would there be first-party coverage under the example the Chief Justice is giving you under that policy?
There would be, Justice, and that was going to be part of my response.
But will that cover my meds?
No, Justice. You would have, by definition, as a matter of law, if you have an auto liability policy, you will also have an insured motorist coverage. If Justice Bradley does not have a liability policy of her own, then the UM coverage would kick in and cover your damages. If she has a policy, but your damages exceed her liability policy, then you would have the opportunity to claim under UIM policy.
I know, and that could be very limited amounts, the way that's been interpreted.
Well, I think a policyholder has the option of purchasing whatever limits they wish from first-party coverage.
Would it make a difference in this case if the employee, say it wasn't a fairly large corporation, but a small mom-and-pop place, and they had no insurance? What would Ms. Blazing's position be if there was no other insurance company covering the forklift operator?
Then under that circumstance, it would be the same result regardless of
uninsured motorists.
The rules wouldn't change depending on the size of the tortfeasor.
No, I only brought that up because it's more likely a large corporation is going to have fairly extensive coverage. But my point is, so what you answered in response to the question from the Chief Justice and Justice Rogensack would be applicable in this scenario had there been no insurance that would cover the forklift operator, the Menards forklift operator.
Correct.
Not to put too fine a point on it, and then I'm done. So the same uninsured motorist coverage would apply to Ms. Blazing had there been no other insurance covering the forklift operator?
Yes.
Okay.
But doesn't that beg the question as to whether or not there is any other insurance? As a tortfeasor, I may or may not have a separate insurance policy. But the question here, in part, is whether this tortfeasor is an insured under American Family. And if the answer to the question that the tortfeasor is an insured under American Family, then you have the potential to cover under the liability portion and not just the uninsured. So your answer subsumes the very question that we are presented with here, seems to me.
Well, and that, I think, gets to the question, ultimately, right, of the two interpretations of the statutory language I indicated and the question of whether the position adopted by Menards is an absurd, as that term is used in the law, interpretation of the statute.
Loading and unloading a use covered under the terms of the American Family Insurance Policy?
It has been interpreted to include loading and unloading, yes, use, mm-hmm. in the context of starting with Lauver and that whole discussion, the many cases that developed mm-hmm. the concept of use over the years, looking at it, but looking at it from the, if we put aside the omnibus statute and look at the policy language, I think that goes back to our argument under Lauver that there isn't necessarily just one test to determine whether a particular activity is a use. And because the case talks about what is usually applied, and as we've indicated, all of the cases that have discussed Lauver and have considered use apply that test, and the way that test is applied makes sense in the fact patterns that have arisen because they all involve negligent insureds who are seeking a defense and indemnity for a third-party claim or a first-party claim.
And
my final point on that is I would suggest that under these circumstances, it calls for an alternate test.
I think an argument can be made under your policy that there's a bit of ambiguity in what you mean by use. And the reason I say that is because the policy, and the students should listen to this because you might be interested in this part of it. The policy defines use as use. That's a little bit of a problem, isn't it?
It's a definition that I've seen it in many standard policies,
could. Just because everyone is doing it doesn't mean that you should be doing it. How many times have you heard that?
It could be defined differently, yes, although I think the case law has developed definitions of use.
Sure, but under the policy, the case law has developed definitions because under the policy, if you define use as use, now to be fair, of course, I'm just taking the third alternative. Use means ownership, maintenance, or use. Okay, but that's what I want to give a complete picture. But use means use, which I think ipso facto means there's a little ambiguity as to what that determination means. And, of course, the maxim of contract interpretation for insurance policies is what, she asks, and then answers, if it's ambiguous, you construe it in favor of the insured. So why don't you just go, why doesn't this case be resolved just on that route?
Well, I don't think a term is ambiguous just because it's not defined further in the policy. And if we talk about the universe of activities that could equate with use, mm-hmm. I think it would be literally impossible to itemize everything, and I suspect that's why the definition is what it is. And I've seen alternate definitions of use, and they're not too much more in-depth than that. And I think that's where the courts apply common sense to different fact patterns. They apply the Lauver case where it fits to determine whether a particular activity is or is not a use. And it goes back to the basic idea that if a term isn't defined in a policy or if the definition leaves room for interpretation, doesn't mean that it's ambiguous.
How do you define uninsured motorist in your policy?
I will look at that, Justice. And insured under the UM portion of the policy. It's defined to include the named insured, the policyholder, or relative, anyone else occupying your insured car. This one's kind of long. Anyone other than a person or organization claiming by right of assignment or subrogation entitled to recover damages due to bodily injury to you, a relative, or another occupant of your insured car. And then there's a list of four specific categories of people who are not mm-hmm. insured under the UM portion. That would be any person using the vehicle without permission,
mm-hmm.
any person other than a relative using the vehicle with permission but who exceeds the permission, any person using the vehicle without the permission of the person having lawful possession, and finally, any person using a vehicle with permission of the person having lawful possession who exceeds the scope of that permission.
You're defining who's an insured under the policy then. But I understood the question to be
uninsured.
How is uninsured defined?
An uninsured motor vehicle is defined as a vehicle that's not insured by a bodily injury liability bond or policy at the time of the accident.
Yeah, so I go back to my question. My good friend Justice Bradley is insured. She is not an uninsured motorist or an underinsured motorist, and this is not an uninsured vehicle. This is an insured vehicle under your policy, and she is one of the insured. So I don't see how I can recover from her on first-party coverage because she doesn't fit. So I'm just out of luck the way you interpret this policy.
Well, if Justice Bradley is insured under a liability policy...
Pardon me?
Then if Justice Bradley is insured under a liability policy...
She is insured under American Family's my policy. She has no other insurance.
If
she is insured because she is a permissive user within the my permission, and she is clearly, I apologize to you, but clearly negligent. There's no question, and I am clearly hurt. In fact, the more I think about it, the hurter I get. And I just can't see how you can cover her under uninsured or underinsured. She's insured under your policy by definition.
I think that goes back to the question and begs the question, though, Justice, of whether she isn't insured under our policy, which then goes back to...
Well, I'm assuming in my question that she falls under user, okay? And I gave you a very simple, everyday example of her being the driver. I mean, there's no question she's a user, is there, in my example?
Sure.
Okay. And if under my example you're not willing to cover my injuries, then the rest of your argument makes some sense to me. But I'm questioning your basic assumption.
My position would be that she is using your vehicle, but if we again go back to the omnibus statute,
mm-hmm.
Which provides that your policy extends to her
right.
if she's using the vehicle in the same manner and in the same circumstances
right.
as you.
That's right.
If you are in an accident when you're driving, you injure yourself, you don't have liability coverage.
I agree. Totally agree.
Which I believe means that Justice Bradley, under that circumstance,
okay.
would not be insured as a under the liability portion of your policy.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe then you could invoke the UM coverage portion of the policy.
So it really doesn't make any difference whether, in this particular case, Menards has a policy. It doesn't matter anything. If you say that this is a user situation, if you say there's a user situation in this, the answer you have is clearly your policy doesn't cover because I'm the insurer. Ms. Blazing is the insured, and she is not covered for injury that she is suffering. Right?
She would not be covered under her own liability policy.
That's right.
Counsel, if your policy is an excess policy, aren't you here asking for an advisory opinion?
Well, if that were the case, Justice, there'd be an argument for that. But and we don't have Zurich's policy.
Yeah, why don't we have Zurich's policy in this record? I'm often of the opinion when I speak at gatherings and they say, give us hints on how you proceed and what you want in oral argument, I always say if it's an insurance contract case, you should have the insurance contract in the record. So, but my question to you was, if you are an excess carrier here, aren't you here asking for an advisory? Any opinion we would issue would be advisory under the facts of this case.
I don't believe so, Justice, because we do have American Families policy, and we know what the other insurance clause in that policy says.
And what does it say? Does it say you are excess or you're not excess?
It provides, and it's short. I can read it.
I have it in front of me.
Okay. If there is other auto liability insurance for loss covered by this part, we will pay. It's a pro rata.
That's right. A pro rata with what? With Zurich?
Yes.
Okay. And what does Zurich's policy say? Do we know?
We don't, Justice, because the way the case was presented initially, it was a question of whether American Family had coverage at all, not how the two policies interacted. But I think, Justice, regardless of what Zurich's policy says, whether it says it's excess or what it is, our policy is pro rata. And it provides that it's excess only with respect to a vehicle you do not own, you being defined as the policyholder, Ms. Blazing. So I believe regardless of what Zurich's policy says, there would be, if there is a finding that American Family has coverage here, there would be some coverage, so it wouldn't be advisory.
When I looked at the excess discussion provision in the policy, and it said, you do not own, it was unclear to me whether the you is the policyholder or you is the insured. How do you resolve that?
You is the policyholder, Justice, and it is defined, the policyholder and a resident spouse or relative. It's defined at page 1 of 7 of the standard form policy.
In other words, page 1, when you're going looking at definitions, what I went to is page 1 to see how you was defined. That's what I want to know, what the you means. So what number do I go to find out how you is defined?
You is definition number 13 on page 1.
You and your means the policyholder named in the declarations and spouse if living in the same household. So that takes care of the excess, and you're absolutely right. What about the proportion?
The pro rata provision, I believe that, again, because our policy is not excess, by definition, by its terms, at minimum, there would be some exposure if Menards is found to be an insured here.
Isn't that in part dependent upon what the other insurance policy says?
With that language in our policy, I don't believe that it necessarily is.
Not necessarily, but it may be. I mean, I don't know what the other policy says as to excess and primary. Is there a fight about who's excess and who's primary in this case?
That issue has not arisen. The ruling was made before we got past the preliminary question whether American Family had any coverage at all.
So there is no dispute as to who would be excess or who would be primary?
At this point, no issue has arisen. There may be.
Does that mean that there is no issue in this case as to who is excess or primary, or does that mean you have not yet addressed that issue and it hasn't arisen? Which one are we talking about?
That issue has not yet arisen.
Okay, you have not yet addressed it. Is that right?
Correct.
So is the Court of Appeals right in paragraph 6, if both policies provide coverage, the parties apparently intend to dispute which policy is primary? Is that a correct statement of this case?
I don't know if there'll be a dispute. It depends on what the language is. There may or may not be a dispute, or we may agree, but it hasn't been addressed.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Your red light's on. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. It went fast, didn't it?
It did, Justice, yes.
Jeffrey S. Fertel, representing Zurich American Insurance Company and Menard, Inc.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, Counsel, on behalf of the respondents, Menard, Inc. and Zurich American Insurance Company. I think Justice Abrahamson has touched on an issue I think that is very important to discuss here this morning, and that is the fact that despite the issues that and briefing that has been done on the omnibus clause, the point remains that regardless of how this Court would come down on the omnibus clause and whether or not it would violate it to imply an exclusion for the named insured under these circumstances, the American Family policy clearly provides coverage to a permissive user such as Menard, Inc. by its very policy language. The policy language of the American Family policy indicates that it provides coverage for bodily injury to any person due to the use of a vehicle by any person. Now, regardless of whether or not one would imply an exclusion under the omnibus clause that would allow one to exclude coverage for the named insured where the named insured is injured and there's a, by someone who is permissively using their vehicle, there still would have to be language in the American Family policy which specifically excludes coverage for bodily injury to a named insured by a permissive user. And the case that's been cited in the briefs and, in fact, discussed by the amicus, at least initially, was this case called Carroll versus Vulcan. It's a Court of Appeals case, 173 West 2nd, 526. In that very case, there was a discussion as to whether or not a specific policy there involving a motor vehicle handler could require an exclusion of coverage for certain permissive users. And the Court said that even if you could find that a specific provision could be allowed under the omnibus statute, the policy must clearly include such a restriction. In other words, you can't imply it. So in this case, as we've indicated, the American Family policy, first of all, defines an insured under that policy as any person using the vehicle permissively. And secondly, it defines the person that's covered as anyone who sustains bodily injury to any person as a result of permissive use of the vehicle. So accordingly, under any interpretation of that policy, there has to be coverage for Menard, Inc. under this particular circumstance.
It seemed to me that your point is strong in regard to the user issue. The Court of Appeals opinion centered around, it seems to me, my recollection being, the absurd and unreasonable issue. And my question to you is, why isn't it absurd and unreasonable for a policyholder's premium, such as Ms. Blasey, that she has paid out over however many years, to go to pay for the defense of the tortfeasor who harmed her?
Well, I don't think it's an absurd result, Your Honor. I think that what the premium goes to is to protect and provide insurance coverage to that named insured for anyone who is using that vehicle. In other words, the premium's paid to protect anyone and provide coverage for any permissive users of that vehicle. So it's not absurd under these circumstances that if, in fact, someone is injured as a result of permissive use of that vehicle, permissive use given by the insured, the named insured of the policy, that there would be coverage for bodily injury to anyone who sustains harm as a result of that permissive use of the vehicle. That's what the coverage is for.
But do we have any other cases? Do you know of any other cases where it was the policyholder, him or herself, in other words, the one writing the checks for the insurance coverage, who was injured and then through, now obviously greatly watered down by a shared pool of policyholders, but to an extent, was required to fund the defense of the one they are suing?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that we can go all the way back to 1974 in the Allstate versus Truck and Insurance Exchange case. It's what I think is a very analogous type situation And although you have Allstate as the plaintiff, there, that's a case where you have a passenger to a vehicle who has Allstate insurance. The driver of the vehicle is insured by truck in an insurance exchange. As a result of what occurs, as the passenger is getting out of the vehicle, he's got this gun, the gun discharges, it kills the driver of the vehicle who's insured by truck and insurance exchange. So now there's a question, does the Allstate policy apply? Does the truck and insurance exchange policy apply? What Allstate does is Allstate pays an amount to settle the claim of the decedent, the driver of the vehicle. They then go back and sue truck and insurance exchange, saying that truck and insurance exchange was the primary policy that would provide coverage, and therefore they should have paid the $15,000 because the passenger was using the vehicle. And in that case, this court had indicated that looking at this question of usage and what's covered, said since it was consistent with the inherent use of the vehicle, that indeed truck and insurance exchange was required to pay the $15,000 due to the injury to its own named insured by, as a result of use of the vehicle by the passenger under these circumstances.
Under those circumstances, the third party possessed no insurance.
No, they did. Well, they had insurance, Your Honor, through Allstate, but it was also determined by the court that the Allstate policy didn't have coverage here because of a certain exclusion in that policy. So that there was insurance, but therefore there were some competing issues there. But the court ultimately determined, no, there wasn't any coverage under Allstate policy, but indeed there's coverage under the truck and insurance exchange policy under what I would consider to be a very identical fact pattern. And even if in fact the court would have determined that there would have been coverage under the Allstate policy, then I think you get to this issue as to whether or not one policy is primary, one's excess, or whether there's a pro rata share. But it doesn't, I don't think, preclude the coverage that's required under that policy.
Insofar as the use issue goes, I mean, it seemed to me the focus of that case was the removal of the firearm a use of the motor vehicle? And the answer was yes, because if you take a group hunting in your pickup truck, you can expect that as part of a reasonable use that people will be loading and unloading firearms from that vehicle.
Correct. But I think that, it's reflective. I mean, the concept here of a permissive user such as Menards being covered under a liability policy, I don't think is a novel one in this state. I mean, we can go all the way back to 1974, as we've indicated in the Allstate case, where that's been an issue that has been up to the court, and at least under that fact pattern, the court has indicated that there's coverage.
What do you make of the distinction of the scenario that the Chief Justice's hypothetical centered upon, and your opposing counsel spent some time in his brief discussing, in that both in the hypothetical and in the distinction opposing counsel seeks to make, if I loan someone my car, I loan it to poor Justice Bradley, who's without a motor vehicle apparently, for the purpose of our discussion, which is a step up for me because in the conference room I was the third party injured, so I guess I'm doing a little better now. In that scenario, I have selected the person who's going to use my motor vehicle. And so therefore, it could be argued that the insurance company, which has done the risk analysis, presumably, on me, has determined that, yes, it's worth the risk for the premiums that I pay to allow me to choose the user of my insured automobile, and they therefore become an insured under my policy. However, in this case, it certainly didn't seem to be in the record that Ms. Blazing, and it would kind of fly in the face of reality that a customer would have a choice as to who the user of the vehicle, in other words, the driver of the forklift, would be. What do you make of that distinction? What is your response?
Well, I think it's a distinction that I wouldn't say would make a difference, Your Honor, under these circumstances. In other words, I mean, where do we draw the line here as to what would be an appropriate permissive user that I could give permission to use my vehicle so as to have coverage under my policy? Are we now saying that it can only be somebody that I know? I mean, what if I've got a neighbor that I only know peripherally and I allow them to drive my car and they injure me as a result? I mean, is that a circumstance where that I didn't know them well enough or wasn't familiar enough to allow them to give permission? I mean, if I go and I give my vehicle to a valet and they use the vehicle and they injure somebody under those circumstances, is that sufficient enough? If I have a friend of a friend or something that I allow to use my vehicle and they injure me as a result, is that enough familiarity to have permission? I think that is a never-ending scenario, and that is why you cannot draw that distinction. In other words, that if, in fact, the named insured gives permission, and in other words, says, if somebody says, can I load this vehicle for you, and they say yes, that's all the permission that's necessary, I think, under the statute.
Permission is permission.
Permission is permission. Now, one of the scenarios I wanted to address is one consistent with the hypothetical we were talking about this morning, or a little bit earlier about if I allow my friend to drive the vehicle and they don't have insurance coverage. Well, let's flip it and say, let's say I allow my friend to drive the vehicle and they are insured, but they've only got $100,000 in coverage. And that individual is driving the vehicle. We're in a serious car accident, and I have a spinal cord injury. So now I have hundreds of thousands of dollars in my in medical expenses. Under that scenario, why wouldn't it be expected that my policy of insurance would provide coverage to that user that I gave permission to under those circumstances? And in fact,
for what?
Pardon?
Coverage for what? Meds?
Coverage for any bodily injury that I sustain, as the policy indicates.
Okay.
Now, Your Honor, in fact, in this very American Family policy we're dealing with, there is no underinsured coverage. So where in fact, that you could have uninsured coverage, where the scenario is that Justice Bradley is not insured, where there's underinsured coverage, or there's an underinsured amount, in other words, the damages are more than the amount, they would preclude you from recovering under those circumstances under your policy as well, even though you gave permission. Now, that is inconsistent with what this Court has said over the years as to the purpose of the omnibus clause, and that is that it is to expand coverage. It's to help and provide coverage to injured parties as well as permissive users of the vehicle.
Well, you know, Justice Bradley is covered under the American Family, as American Family does it. The only thing is, she doesn't have to pay me. She doesn't have to pay me. That's all.
Well, you know, but that is contrary, Your Honor, to all of the wording in that policy. I mean, we've got a policy that says bodily injury to any person. It doesn't say we're restricting it only to people other than the named insured. And I guess after all this brief, go ahead, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Suppose it did say no coverage for the named insured when there's a permissive user like this, okay? Would that be appropriate? Would that be upheld? Is that contrary to public policy? Is it contrary to uninsured motorist?
I think it's contrary to the omnibus clause, Your Honor, and that is because the statute, I think, is very clear in that the coverage that is to be supplied is, if it's supplied to the named insured, the same type of coverage and the same type of provisions has to be applied to the additional insurance.
Yeah, but they argue that if I injure myself, I don't recover. If I'm negligent, right?
Yes.
If I leave the car in gear and it runs over me in my own driveway, I'm not going to recover. So why should I recover when Justice Bradley is behind the wheel and negligently, not intentionally, runs over me?
Because of the fact that that's a person who's defined as an additional insured under your policy. It's because it says any person and for any bodily injury. Now, if, you know, the thing that's interesting about this entire argument is that nowhere does American Family indicate that they couldn't have avoided this result if they would have, incorporated some type of an exclusion, some type of other type of an exclusion, or even through the use of the other insurance clauses.
I thought you just said the exclusion would be contrary to the omnibus statute as you interpret it.
The one that Justice Abrahamson was talking about. Now, the court has also indicated that if, in fact, the exclusions apply equally to both the named insured as well as any additional insureds or permissive users under the policy, that those exclusions can indeed be upheld under the omnibus clause.
Well, under the policy, if the insured hurt herself, she has first-party coverage, so it wouldn't be liability coverage. So I'm not sure what it is you're saying.
No, what I'm saying...
Seeking liability coverage, and under the policy, the named insured, if she injures herself in what she does, she could make a claim for first-party coverage.
Well, when we're talking about first-party coverage, I guess that would be for medical payments or whatever coverage,
right,
et cetera. But in fact, if in fact you would be limited under those circumstances to those MedPay provisions of your policy, and there's nothing in the policy that would preclude the injury by a third party to you. We're not talking about the named insured injuring themselves and then seeking to recover under the policy. We're talking about a scenario where a permissive user third party has caused the harm by use of the vehicle that the named insured gave permission to use.
Right, but the policy basically stands the permissive user in the shoes of the named insured. I mean, that's what the policy tries to do. It gives what it gives to the named insured to the permissive user, correct?
The same extent of the coverage, yes.
All right, okay. So I guess I don't quite understand your answer to the question.
Well, if in fact there is my answer is this, is that it's not the named insured that's seeking coverage. It's the third party that's seeking coverage. In other words, it's the permissive user. And that's where the liability insurance kicks in. And that is because the third party, who is the permissive user, is seeking coverage, liability coverage under that policy. And the issue becomes, is there any basis in which to distinguish who the injured party is, where there's third-party coverage that's being sought?
Right. I think that that's certainly your argument, which I understand well. The argument on the other side is, would someone really pay a premium on a policy to insure somebody else who injures them? I mean, that's the argument that's on the other side. Is that really what the parties reasonably contemplated when this policy was purchased?
I think that the reasonable expectations of the insured is that you're purchasing coverage that would cover anyone who you give permission to use your vehicle. That's what the premium is being paid for.
No matter whom they injure. So if if I buy a policy and I have the same kind of coverage and a friend of mine is driving my car and injures me, I have to pay for the defense of that person to try to show that person wasn't negligent in injuring me when I want that person to be found negligent. And I have to pay for any coverage under that same policy. That's the premium I paid.
Yes, that's the premium. Your insurance coverage, you have paid, and the American Family or any other insurer has taken on risk for permissive use of your vehicle under the scenarios defined by that policy. And if, in fact, some permissive user, third party, causes injury, under those circumstances, the premium pays for that risk. And whether that risk is you as the named insured or as any other third party that may have been injured. The interesting thing, I guess, from listening to the arguments here, I don't know where American Family draws the line. I mean, are they saying that this court is to, first of all, they say there should be a different test other than the Lauber test. I haven't heard yet any different test articulated by American Family as to what would cover this particular scenario.
I think what they argue basically is this is not within the reasonable contemplation of the insured when the insured bought this policy.
Well, the reason, but Lawver specifically indicated that the reasonable expectations of the insured, at least the intent, is in an omnibus use case such as this, is most usually defined by whether or not the use of the vehicle, it's the activity that gives rise to the injury, is consistent with the inherent use of the vehicle. I mean, there's no distinction in any of the case law, whether that's from Wisconsin or the omnibus clauses or any other jurisdictions, that makes a distinction as to who the injured party is. I mean, in other words, the named insured versus some third party.
Counsel, let me perhaps beg to differ with you. Ohio stands out there alone, apparently. In preparation for your argument and briefing here today, did you have occasion to review Couch on Insurance or Appleman on Insurance addressing this issue?
Your Honor, we did some general looking through the treatises, yes.
And I'm quoting from Appleman on Insurance Law and Practice, section 4322, pages 29 to 32, and notes 84-84.35. It says, the omnibus clause has been extended to cover third parties engaged in loading and unloading operation. And coverage would be found where the accident arose out of the loading process. Persons actively engaged in the loading or unloading process with the permission of the named insured are additional insureds under the omnibus clause. And there's a collection of cases for each of these premises. But now I get to Ohio. It says this, quote, Ohio alone has held that for a party to be insured under a liability policy omnibus clause in his loading and unloading activities, he must first be an insured under terms of the policy on some other basis by some other use of the vehicle. Again, a collection of cases. So apparently there is one jurisdiction that might find it unreasonable, but all of these other jurisdictions have, I haven't read all the cases cited. One of them is this recent Illinois case, the Menards versus Country Preferred.
Right.
But all of them apparently are in your favor, save Ohio.
And I apologize, Your Honor, I haven't had a chance to look at that particular case or that scenario, but it didn't sound to me from what you were reading, and I certainly would stand corrected after reading the cases, but that there was a distinction being made as to who was injured. In other words, that if it was the named insured seeking to collect damages versus some other party, that that under that scenario, there would be a distinction made under this statute. And, I think that's a problem. I mean, I think it's a problem for American Family, given the wording not only of the omnibus clause, in which we're indicating here, but by the wording of their own policies under these circumstances. You know, I think the fact that, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier during my argument, is the fact remains is that the coverage that we're talking about here, the omnibus coverage, whether it be under the statute or whether it be under the terms of the policy, is coverage that goes with the vehicle. You know, we're not and the case law talks about the fact that the coverage goes with the vehicle as opposed to any particular person. And therefore, you can see the logical progression of the cases has focused upon whether or not the scenario involved use of the vehicle. Because of the policies being broad enough to say that any person is covered who's using the vehicle, the statute says you have to give equivalent coverage to both the named insured as well as any permissive additional insurers. So therefore, you have a scenario where the cases have developed in Lawver and so on, where the court has focused upon the vehicle and whether coverage goes with the vehicle.
What is most troublesome to me about your argument is that there is an obligation to defend that rides along with the coverage argument. And, you know, you can say whoever is injured needs to be compensated under the liability policy. That has a common appeal. But what troubles me is that this woman who was injured has paid a premium that requires the policy to defend the person she's trying to sue. Okay? They have to defend that person against her claim, and she paid that premium. Frankly, that doesn't seem reasonable to me. It doesn't seem that she would reasonably think when she bought this policy, she was paying to defend the person she's trying to sue to determine they're obligated to pay for her injury.
Well,
I have a problem with that.
You see, to me, that the example is not unreasonable or absurd. I mean, you have the same situation in a first-party case, in other words, where you have an uninsured motorist situation.
That's a separate level of coverage. Well, it's a contractual coverage. It's not based on any fault of anyone.
Well,
first-party claim is.
You still have a scenario, though, where the situation where your own insurance company is going to take a position adverse to you, potentially, in the sense of whether or not that uninsured motorist is at fault for this incident and whether or not the injuries that you're being claimed indeed are sufficient are consistent with the evaluation that the insurance company has made as to the amount of compensation due and owing. So there's a scenario there where you're saying your own insurance company is going to be hiring their own insurance attorney on behalf of American Family to defend an underinsured or uninsured motorist.
That's a coverage question. That's a coverage question.
Well, it's...
I'm talking about the duty to defend is what bothers me, that this woman paid for a policy that has to provide a defense for the person she's suing, saying, this person hurt me and they should compensate me. Oh, but she had to pay for a premium that now defends against her own claim. I just think that's difficult.
Well, as I've indicated earlier, she's paid a premium that would cover the defense of anyone who she permissively allows to use her vehicle. Now, I mean, the other scenario would be, let's say that you have your friend in your car, and you have the rest of your family in the car, and you've got your three children and yourself, and you're injured under that scenario. Is that person that is using or operating your car in that scenario entitled to a defense and indemnification under your policy, under your liability policy, where they've injured your children?
So what coverage does she get? What does she get under her own insurance policy then? What does her insurance company do for her? Under your scenario, her insurance defends the person that injured her. But under your scenario, what does her insurance do for her? Anything?
Well, you mean what does American Family do for the insurance?
The person that paid for the policy.
Well, they would have their obligations under the MedPay portions of the policy. They'd have their same obligations under their uninsured.
They don't have any duty to advocate for her. They only have a duty to defend against her claim. Is that your position?
They have an obligation to defend, to appoint a separate attorney who are ethically bound to defend the permissive user of the vehicle from whom coverage is being sought.
So the person that injured her gets a defense, and she's left alone. She would have to find another lawyer and try to sue on her own behalf.
Well,
she wouldn't get any help from American Family under the policy that she paid for.
Yeah, correct. But she wouldn't be entitled to any assistance if this was a particular case where there wasn't use involved. She wouldn't get any assistance from American Family under the circumstance either.
But you agree there was use involved.
Right. Well, there's permissive use that she gave under this policy. She wouldn't be entitled to any assistance from American Family in terms of the prosecution of her claim, just as in any personal injury claim. She would have her own attorney that would be representing her. American Family wouldn't get involved in the prosecution of her bodily injury claim.
Could I ask, in this case, Ms. Blazing sued Zurich?
Yes, and Menards.
Would they have had to sue Menards?
No. Not under the direct action statute, no, Your Honor.
So So you're asking that American Family pay Zurich's legal defense?
Well, we're asking that they defend the tortfeasor under the circumstances, which is Menards, which is allegedly Menard Inc. And that's the same as if Zurich's involved or it isn't. In other words, Zurich's liability only arises out of the alleged negligence of Menard Inc. under these circumstances. So what is being requested is that the tortfeasor, the alleged tortfeasor, Menard Inc., be defended and indemnified under the permissive user portion of the policy.
So could the defendants win the case?
Yeah, so they could win the case by establishing that there was no negligence on the part of Menard Inc.
I think the point that my colleagues are making is that American Family does not pay for any of the legal expenses of its insured. It is being asked to pay the legal expenses of people opposing its insured, and in fact, a competitive insurance company.
Well, yeah, they're being asked to provide an indemnification and a defense to an entity that was considered to be an additional insured under the American Family policy. They don't get there unless and until there is permissive use of the vehicle that's the subject of the policy. And once there's permissive use under that policy, they have an obligation to defend and indemnify that permissive user. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Pliner.
Thank you, Justice. May it please the Court. A few points I wanted to touch on. First of all, going back to the question that the Court raised about whether you would be issuing an advisory opinion, we talked a bit about the duty to defend, and that, of course, is a key issue here. And regardless of what the other insurance clauses result in terms of coverage, the duty to defend is something that would kick in immediately upon a finding of coverage. So the opinion would not be advisory.
Counsel, do you think bad faith could play any role in this analysis?
Bad faith of?
The insurance company. Given their obligations under the policy to the insured.
Given American Family's obligations?
If we were to rule against you today.
Sure. American Family would be put in the very difficult position of defending a claim against its own insured under the liability portion of the policy. It has a duty and an obligation, a fiduciary duty to its insured. So those would certainly raise some very difficult questions.
Counsel, when you use the word insured in response to Justice Ziegler's question, I hear you really saying to your policyholder, because isn't that the question right here, whether or not the person loading and unloading is an insured? Right?
Yes.
So you really meant the policyholder as opposed to a potential loading and unloading.
Right.
As I am for clarification. I want to follow up on this duty to defend that you referenced, and it was referenced previously. In looking at your brief, I didn't see any cite to Couch or Appleman either. One of the cases that's cited in Appleman is from New York, and it deals with the similar facts as we have here, that an injured insurer must defend and indemnify a tortfeasor who injured the insured during the loading and unloading. And that court said, this result hardly accords with traditional notions of who should bear responsibility for negligent conduct. The court ought not to make bad law, however, in order to force a different conclusion. Now, according to Appleman, the only jurisdiction that supports your position is Ohio. I haven't read, I've only looked at a couple of the cases cited. Do you have authority to contest Appleman's assertions? As I read, Ohio alone has held that for a party to be insured under a liability omnibus clause in his loading and unloading activities, he must first be an insured under terms of the policy on some other basis by some other use of the vehicle.
Justice, we had looked nationwide for cases, and we didn't find anything on that issue that would address the same argument that we're making here, the absurdity argument.
Mm-hmm. Suppose in this case, instead of the policyholder being injured, it was the neighbor traveling with Ms. Bleasing. Would your company pay? Would your company defend in this case?
I think under that scenario, Justice, there's certainly a much better argument that they would have to. I think we still have the issue of whether the clerk who's putting something in the back of the truck should qualify as a permissive user. But if we put that aside, then yes, it's a third party who's injured by the tortfeasor.
No problem. Because you'd have to defend.
I suspect we would. We may have arguments to the contrary, but I suspect that would end up being the result.
If American Family has to pay to defend Zurich, do they get to determine who represents Zurich?
That would certainly be our position, yes, if that were the result. A couple of other points I'd like to touch on, if I may. Public policy is a big issue here, too, and the WIA addressed that in their amicus brief. I think some of the questions that the court raised touches on the public policy consideration and the concerns about having the injured person's carrier basically defend the tortfeasor. It goes back to the classic rule that tortfeasors should be held responsible. And what this really is at the end of the day is shifting responsibility from the tortfeasor, at least partially, not only to someone else, but to the injured person and to the injured person's insurance carrier. And I think that's a significant public policy consideration that needs to be taken into account.
Are there any other questions? If not, I want to thank Mr. Kleiner and Mr. Fertel for their arguments today on a omnibus clause interpretation. This is not the first time the omnibus clause or user have come before the court, but in a very different posture. So I want to thank you for your briefs and thank you for your argument. And that ends the hearing in 12 AP 858, Bleasing versus Zurich American Insurance Company et al. The court will take a few minutes recess so the students, if they are leaving, may leave and other students may come in if there are other students to come in. And so we are in recess for a few moments.